Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is 2:45, time to start. My lecture this afternoon concerns financial markets in a free society. Which will have a follow-up for those who attend the graduate seminar tomorrow in another lecture with the title Financial Markets in the State. So one difficulty of talking about financial markets and illustrating this today is that financial markets, that we don't have a free society, especially when it comes to financial markets. And so I'll say more about this later on when we look at some figures. And so our theoretical analysis cannot be directly applied to present conditions. But it's, as always, it's a necessary starting point for analyzing markets. This is something that you find in all great classical economists and also in the Austrian economists, in the writings of the Austrian economists. In order to understand the real world, we need to separate two kinds of influences. One influence comes from the operation of the free market. It is a social arrangement based on the respect of private property rights. And a fundamentally different influence comes from the side of politics, or more precisely from the institutionalized violation of private property rights. Most problems of today's financial markets and today's markets in general, for which some people chide capitalism, are in fact due to government interventionism. Which brings us to another topic, which I will just barely scratch by saying that in discussing with opponents of capitalism and the market economy, it's always useful to clarify terms first. And very often people talk past one another, and they mean different things. So when an Austrian economist talks about capitalism and he praises capitalism, when some other free market economist praises capitalism, what they do not mean is the current economic reality. Like saying, well, the U.S. has a capitalist economic system. Or China has a capitalist economic system. Or something like this. Of course, you're free to use the word as you wish. Only you need to be clear what you mean. Right? If this is what you mean, right, the currently really existing system is capitalism, well, then this is not what we're talking about. Clearly, we are not praising this. But what it is, in fact, is a combination, it's a mixture of free market forces on the one hand and of government interventionism on the other hand. So analytically, we need to separate this. We cannot separate the real world, right? We cannot tear apart the real world. We cannot create a laboratory experiment. And even if we wish so, it would probably not be very funny to do this. And we shouldn't play games with people and so on. So we need to do this intellectually, right, as a thought experiment. So the first part of the thought experiment is always to analyze how would a market work? How would a free market work? How would a free society operate? And the market is a particular element of a free society. It's not all of the free society, right? Again, when we use the word market, we need to be clear. Do we mean social relationships based on exchange, based on the payment of prices? Or do we mean something more general? There's also another source of confusion. I prefer always to use the word market in the narrow sense, social relationships based on or premised on the payment of prices. And in that sense, the market is a part of the free society. It's not the society, right? Because there are other things, other social relations that are not based on payments. Relations within the family, within associations, friendship, and so on. So today we are talking about free markets. In a free society, all markets would look like in a free society. What role do they play in a free society? One of the main points that I wish to stress is that financial markets would actually play a rather limited role in a free society. So it's a big error, a very, very widespread error, unfortunately, today, to take in financial markets as they presently exist, the embodiment of a free society. Ludwig von Mises once rightly observed that the stock market is a characteristic feature of a free economy. Where you have a stock market, you do not have pervasive socialism. That's impossible. And on the other hand, you cannot have socialism if you admit a stock market, right? It's precisely because you have different ownership. You trade ownership rights in companies. But it should not follow from there. We should not draw the conclusion that whatever phenomena we observe in the financial market, whatever activity exists, is a manifestation of capitalism, of free market capitalism. That's not true. To a very large extent, financial markets today are the result, sometimes the unintended consequence, but sometimes also the intended consequence, of government interventionism. So one of the things, therefore, that we should learn, that we should be aware of, is that financial markets are not strictly logically necessary for the operation of a market economy. Right? Although Mises is correct, a stock market is a characteristic feature of the market economy, it's not a necessary feature of the market economy. Right? And that finance in a free society has different ways, very different mechanisms that come into play, apart from financial markets. So let's start off, as usual, with definitions. What is a financial market? On financial markets, people exchange promises of future payments. The promise of a future payment is a future good. So the characteristic feature of financial markets is to exchange future goods. It's not the only future good, right? Factors of production are also future goods. So a promise of payment is a future good. And what do we exchange them against? Well, typically monetary payments, that is, we exchange them against present goods. But sometimes we exchange them against other promises of future payments, right? So the characteristic feature is the exchange of promises of future payments. Now, these promises are typically formalized in some way, right? So we speak of a financial title because we have some sort of a written promise that's a financial title. And usually also they are standardized. And you can have I can make a promise to you tomorrow, I'll pay you $13.28. And so I'll write this down so this would be a financial title, right, in that definition. But usually what we do is to standardize them. Right, and guarantee them also in some sort of form. And then we speak about securities. Right? Security is a special type of financial title, but the most widespread type. Now, how do financial titles fit into the general scheme of property titles? You see here, fundamentally, we can have property titles to presently existing goods and to goods that are expected to exist in the future. Presently existing goods. So this is not meant to be really exhaustive or systematic. I'll just list it down. The major classes: consumer durables, money, capital goods, real estate. Not only consumer durables, right? I mean, you can have also, theoretically speaking, would it be possible to have a property title to the apples that are in your fridge or, right, to the butter in your fridge, but we don't do this. It's a question of the economics of issuing financial of titles, right? So we don't establish property rights for chunks of butter and for apples and things like this, right? But for consumer durables, typically in Europe, for example, we have titles for cars. In the U.S., we have cadastre entry, right, for titles for real estate and so on. So we have property title, money, right? We have accounts from the bank issued, and capital goods. Capital goods very often, because they belong to firms, right? There's not a separate title that exists to the capital good per se. As far as financial title is concerned, so there are different types, and I won't go into that detail because we are not today concerned with these technical features of different financial titles. So those of you who have who are studying financial markets in your studies, you maybe have a class of financial markets, you're studying economics, right? Then this is the place where you would go walk through the characteristic features of shares as compared to bonds and so on, right? So here I would just hold up very generally, right? There are titles that concern residual revenue from firms, and this concerns most notably shares, right? Then we have contractual revenue, IOUs. Another big group is swaps, is a derivative instrument. And then future ownership, which concerns, again, so-called derivative financial titles, futures, options, etc. So an option is a piece of paper, as you wish, that is today is no longer issued as paper. As a security, usually exists in electronic form that gives you the right to claim in the future, typically in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, a payment under certain conditions from some other person. Right? All of this is not relevant for us today, because we're not imbued with these concerned with these technical questions, but with the general role of financial markets within the market economy. One weakness, so let me say this nevertheless, one weakness of present-day textbooks on financial markets is that they are overwhelmingly concerned with such technical questions. And you will find very exhaustive, descriptive parts on different characteristics of various financial titles. You find very nice analyses of financial market institutions, how stock markets operate, the different exchanges in different parts of the world, monetary policy, and so on. Right? Some textbooks are really very good in that respect. For example, the number one textbook in that field is authored by a Federal Reserve governor, with whom I will not name now. Yes, he's really a very good book with a title, I think, is Money, Banking, and Financial Markets. There's several textbook outs with this title. So it's very good in the descriptive part, but it's very unsatisfactory when it comes to analyzing the macroeconomic role played by financial market. And so this is precisely what is important from an Austrian point of view, and also from the point of view of classical economists. So we'll go into this detail today. This is our plan. We have just two points on our menu. We'll talk first about the uses of savings in society. As financial markets are supposed to channel savings from one end of the economy to the other, and that's indeed what they exclusively do in a free society. Once the government comes into place, we have also something else. Yesterday, Professor Bargos told us about fractional reserve banking, and he stressed the fact that fractional reserve banks create money by creating credit. So these two processes are intermingled. So we see here that in such a society as we have today, credit has two distinct sources. One is savings, and the other one is money creation. So financial markets are not pure intermediaries of savings today. They are also premised on the creation of money. But again, so I will not go into that today. And then finally, we'll talk a little bit about the factors coming into play in the emergence and takeoff of financial markets. And we'll again talk a little bit about government interventionism. Okay, the uses of savings. So this slide, I start at the top, right? So we'll work my way down to the bottom. This slide is important. So here we talk about the various ways savings can be used within the market economy. One basic way to use it, so fundamentally we can distinguish of uses of savings outside the division of labor and then within the division of labor. On Monday, you have followed my talk on the division of labor and social order. And one of the main points that I emphasized was that the division of labor is premised on savings. The larger is the volume of savings, the more roundabout can production processes be. That is, the more opportunities and, in fact, necessity for specialization exists. So savings are a fundamental factor in the division of labor. But we have also seen in our basic example that, of course, savings can also promote the productivity, increase the productivity of human labor, even if there's no society. Right? So the fisherman example, the Crusoe example. Right? And, of course, this is the least interesting case for us. Right? Crusoe can, and that's what we have seen in our example, right? He can use the fishes that he saves to finance future production. And he can use the fishes that he saves to finance future consumption. He can have a nice day on the beach. And he's not engaged in any productive venture. He's just consuming. Or he can eat and build a net or build other things. So what is being financed is always human consumption. But consumption can be productive or purely consumptive. It's a distinction that has been already been made by Adam Smith. You can distinguish between productive consumption and pure consumption. So we will focus on savings and the final uses of savings within the division of labor. Here again, we face two fundamental possibilities. The first one is that the saver uses his own savings. Again, he uses it for consumption, for deferred consumption. I do not consume everything today. I set some of the stuff apart, and I will consume it tomorrow. And he can also use his savings for investments in his own firm. And in a society in which we do not have any other form of cooperation between human beings, there is no financial cooperation with human beings, so it's just a division of labor, there is no credit in particular, then the only way you use your savings is in the form of equity, capital that you own in your own company, and you spend it. And so I set apart a certain revenue that I've gained in the past by services that I've provided to other people. So maybe I've earned, whatever, $10,000. And now I use these as my savings. I didn't spend them on consumer goods. Now I start using them to set up my own firm. What do I do when I set up my own firm? Well, it's not necessarily that I have an office or something like this, but I start buying factors of production. That's what you do. That's the essential activity. I buy factors of production, use those factors of production to create a product and then sell the product. So I use my own past savings to buy factors of production. I buy raw materials. I buy tools. I buy intermediate goods. I hire people. You hire less people in France because it's very expensive. There are a lot of taxes and social security that you have to pay. So there are people spend a little less on labor. But that's what you do. And then you generate a product and everything goes as planned. By selling the product, you will have a revenue that exceeds your costs. You've made a profit. So I spend $10,000. Maybe I earn a revenue of $12,000. Fine. Now I can go on. I reinvest out of the selling proceeds, $12,000. I invest again. Maybe we buy the same quantities as before, right? In a static economy, buy always the same thing. What do I do? So I create now revenue within my own firm, and out of that revenue, I constitute, again, some savings. Right? Before, I was saving outside of my firm. I was maybe providing labor services to somebody else. Now I'm setting up my own firm. I'm gaining revenue within the firm. I'm reinvesting this revenue. And that sum that I reinvest is, in fact, my savings. I've earned $12,000. Out of the $12,000, I spend $10,000 again on my employees and on buying raw materials. These are the savings that I make within the company. That's an important point. And the savings, the bulk of the savings in our society are made within, juridically, within the context of companies. Because after all, I could have consumed my entire revenue. I could have taken the $12,000 and just have a nice vacation somewhere, etc. So there's no investment going on. There's no saving going on. It's just all consumer expenditure. At that point, I always tell my students, so we should be very happy for all the billionaires around who do not spend all of this on their little indulging jewelry or nice hotels or whatever else. There are lots of things on which you can spend money. Fortunately, most of the stuff they do not spend on for their own consumption. They reinvest, that is, they save. Most of the money of very rich people is actually saved and reinvested. So this is what you can do. And we can imagine a market economy that operates only with companies that are financed in that way. And so all companies, I mean, to the extent that their savings are built up, are made within the company, and then you reinvest it in that company, or used to set up new companies. There's no financial intermediation at all. Or maybe there are partnerships. And if we look at the history of finance, this is actually how the market economy evolved. This is how it became big. Right? Until the 19th century, there was not much of a financial division of labor to finance companies. Companies were typically financed out of equity, that is, out of revenue gained in the past by selling products. Some form of debt existed, most notably in the form of what we call commercial debt, so which means that if you deliver goods and services to a client, the client does not pay you on the spot. You say, well, you pay me in 2 months or in 3 months. The standard procedure today is commercial. This is called commercial credit. I provide a service. I'm not paid at once. What does this mean? That means I give a credit to the company to which I've delivered those goods. So commercial credit in that sense has always played some role and has played an important role since the Middle Ages. But compared to the overall volume of money spent by companies, it was very small. In some areas, even commercial credit had a very bad press among businessmen. So I discovered a couple of months ago with much astonishment that commercial credit was outlawed within the Hanseatic League. So some of you, who has heard of the Hanseatic League here? Okay, some, a select few. Yeah. So all others, you go to the internet. There's a good Wikipedia article on the Hanseatic League. The main authority in the field is a Frenchman, the name of Philippe Dollinger. He's from Alsace. It's not a region adjacent to the sea. This is a typical case. Sometimes you have people who are just land people, but they're fascinated by everything relating to the sea, so they become great experts. Right? There's another case. I recently came across another guy who was the major expert on the French fleet or French military fleet, and it was a guy who has lived all of his life in the very center of France. Never got to the sea. Was fascinated by this. So Dollinger has the book in French is La Hanse. And I think in English it's the Hanseatic League, and I think there it's a Google document, right? So you can read it for free. It's great. So Dollinger points out that the Hanseatic League was an association of German merchants that did business in the Baltic area, right? The Baltic Basin, and in fact, After 2 centuries or so, covered all of Northern Europe with their trade and until the Atlantic. And so they set up lots of settlements and did business right between different countries and so on. It's a fascinating thing. I can't go into the detail. And they had some rules for dealing amongst themselves. One of the rules was cash payment only. No credit. If you cannot pay cash, you're no longer a decent merchant. We cannot admit you to our circle. So you lose all privileges and so on. Now, Dollinger says, well, this is excessive. It's true, right? It is excessive, right? It's certainly not something that we can reconcile with libertarian principles or something like this. But I must say, I felt very sympathetic toward this, as compared to the excesses of our own day. Right? It looks absurd. Why wouldn't you admit some credit, commercial credit? And it's true, right? It is somewhat absurd. But on the other hand, if you look at what we have, the situation that we have today, in which lots of people are in excessive debt, right? So A owes to B, B owes to C, C owes to A, right? And if one of them goes bankrupt, all other guys are hurt. And nobody knows exactly. Then you spend months on sorting out who owns what, who has the right on having what. So this is a very pragmatic rule, in fact. So look, I mean, from the overall point of view, there's no change whether you admit credit or not. And we'll get to this point. It's an important thing. But we avoid all this trouble. So it's a harsh ruling, but it's not senseless. Right? Probably they had lived through some of such situations, A, B, C, D, etc. And you have the go around of debt. And then once they went, a few guys went bust, and you went through all the hassle of sorting this out. We said, okay, no more. So compared to our mess today, looks rather sympathetic. So the point is, right, such an economy can work, and in fact has worked and has existed. In the Hanseatic League, there was virtually no debt. There were partnerships, and partnerships was also the preferred way of sharing risks. Right? You didn't own a ship all on your own, was too risky. All your money was sent in the ship, and then comes a pirate or bad weather and something, you lose all the ship. So you own a share with 4, 8 other businessmen whom you trust. You co-own a ship. You co-equip a ship. You share the profits. Right? And you have 8 ships of this sort co-owned rather than one ship that you own all alone. As a way of spreading risk. And the Hanseatic League survived from the 12th to the 17th century. Not bad. Right? Not bad. Older than the United States. So it's possible, and not only possible, it's actually workable, it has proved its case. Then, of course, the other fundamental possibilities, and it's not, so it's a logically different possibility, it's not a practical either-or, right? In practice, you can have both. You can have money in your own company, but you can also engage in a financial division of labor. Just as we can engage in a division of labor between rabbit hunters and what was the other thing? Plum pickers or pluckers, yeah, right? So we can engage in the division of labor between savers and the users of savings. Some guys are good at saving. That's the frugal guy and so on. And other guys are good at using savings. I don't mean that the profligate spenders and so on that we have in government, that's not a good use of savings. Also, it seems to me. But I mean, some people are good investors, but right, maybe they come out of a poor family. Or they come out of a family, well, that has immigrated recently or whatever. They don't have much money. He's a great entrepreneur, doesn't have any money. You have another guy who is very frugal, but maybe unimaginative, doesn't know how to run a business and so on. So why shouldn't they get together? Right, you have a division of labor. Here's the division of, sounds weird, right? Financial, division of financial labor. It's financial cooperation. That's what it is. Right? So you have one guy who is doing the saving, or a group of persons who are doing the saving, and other people are using those savings either for consumption or for investment. Here again, we have two fundamentally different forms. We have a contractual corporation, we have a non-contractual one. The contractual one is, of course, easy, right? The two persons find one another. The frugal person says, hey, why don't you invest my money? And then we share the profits. Either you pay me a fixed return, right? So you have a debt contract, or we share the profits. So it's a sharing of the residual revenue. Right? Different things can be worked out. Doesn't concern us now. So here we have a contract between the saver and the user of his savings. Now, the fascinating thing is that there are also non-contractual transfers. As a central theme in economic analysis, you have the intended consequences of human action, you have the unintended consequences of human action. And very often the unintended consequences are more important than the intended one. And in the lecture on money, I think Professor Bagos has pointed out that money emerged not necessarily as something that is planned from the outset, but as the consequence of human action. You have people benefiting from indirect exchange. And so they are converging on using finally the same medium of exchange. And so you have the emergence of money, although the monetary economy had not been planned by any individual market participant. And the very similar thing we have also in the case of savings. Now, the case that we have here is the following. It concerns the transfers resulting from saving in the form of cash. Or in other words, hoarding money. Okay. I have revenue, the 12,000, and now I don't spend them on consumer goods, but I don't spend them on factors of production either. I keep them in my pocket. Or maybe I dig a deep hole in my garden and bury them there. In the night, yeah. So nobody should look then. Right? If your neighbor see you, well, he's digging and so on. Get other people who will dig after you. Right. So this, ladies and gentlemen, is and has always been the standard form of savings for most people. Most people, especially most poor people, save in the form of cash holding. That was the almost universal form of saving until, again, the 19th century. And even today, Americans like financial markets a lot, right? American households have a lot of financial products, own a lot of financial products, financial titles. We'll look at some of the figures later. But even Americans hold a lot of cash. I think Americans own whatever a total of something like $70 trillion of assets. Okay. American GDP is what approximately? 15, very good. Huh? So American GDP is $15 trillion. Total assets owned by American households is 70. Okay. So you see, each time I tell this to my students, in Angers, I always get the reaction, oh, wow, but then we have still a long way to go. It's true. Right? There's still a lot of things that you can expropriate. Right? Out of the 70, so Americans like financial titles a lot, so they own something like almost $50 trillion of financial titles. Right. But even Americans have eight trillion of cash. Okay, this is a very substantial sum. In other countries, it's much more. In Germany, it's relatively much more. Very poor countries, it's virtually only cash. Many Chinese households today, many Indian households, are just saving cash, and also not only in the form of the national fiat money, but also in the form of natural monies, right? So this hoarding gold coins or silver coins or something like this, right? Why is this? Well, because you want to be sure, you're mostly concerned when you're saving that you preserve the value. And cash holding, well, there's no investment risk, right? If you invest in a company, you risk that the company goes bust. If you buy government bonds, you risk that the government will not repay you. It's not a completely absurd scenario, as we know by now, right? Most people don't want this. Most people are not entrepreneurs. Most people are of the frugal type who just want to preserve their value but don't want to run any risk. Now come our Keynesian friends and they say, ah, this is terrible. And their predecessors in the Middle Ages say, ah, dear. This is the cash holders are the misers. Right? He's holding onto his money. It's like the vampire of the economy. He's getting everything together and he's draining the blood out of the body of the economy. And, oh. So the economy collapses, right? It's, all these metaphors, right? You know, money is like blood in a body and so on. You know? So you need to have a lot of blood and fresh blood, always fresh blood. Right. Now, this, of course, is completely wrong. The impact of increased cash holding on the economy is to exercise a pressure on the price level. It exercises a deflationary pressure on the price level. And we withdraw part of the money supply from the economy. So as a consequence, less monetary units are available for exchanges. So the marginal value of each unit increases. Therefore, we only spend it if we can obtain a higher non-monetary price. As before, we would have spent a dollar on a pound of apples. Now we spend the dollar only if we get 1.5 pounds of apples or 2 pounds of apples. So the money price level diminishes. That is not a problem for the economy as a whole. I'll go more into this tomorrow in my lecture on deflation. It's not a problem for the economy as a whole. For the economy as a whole, the crucial thing is always that revenue is higher than cost. But revenue can be higher than cost at a lower price level and at a higher price level. If before my company has earned 12,000 and I've spent 10,000, and now as a consequence of increased cash holding, I only earn 6,000, but I also spend only 5,000, it amounts to the same thing. As an entrepreneur, I'm not better off, I'm not worse off. As a consumer, I'm not better off, neither am I worse off. And of course, I mean, such a process does not have such a neutral impact on the economy, right? There are always winners and losers, like everything in the market economy, right? So it's not just you increase the cash holdings and it's neutral. Right? It doesn't affect anybody negatively. Yeah, some people will be negatively affected. Others will be positively affected. For some people, the prices that they have to pay fall not as much or not as fast as the prices that they obtain for their products. So they lose. And for others, it's the other way around. For others, the prices that they have to pay fall faster or stronger than the prices that they obtain for their own services. But again, from an overall point of view, it doesn't make a difference. Now, why is this a division of labor and finance? Well, if I save more, so I forego the benefit of spending that money, and as a consequence, the price level diminishes, it means that the remaining units of money available and being spent have a higher purchasing power. So it is as though I had given a part of my money, part of my savings to somebody to invest, and another part for other people to buy consumer goods. Because that is exactly what will now happen. All goods fall in their price. So some entrepreneurs can now spend more. They can buy more goods. They cannot spend more, but they can, with their spending, they can buy more goods than before. They can increase their operations. And other people who do not buy factors of production, well, they will buy consumer goods, which are also traded at lower prices. So the difference between the contractual and non-contractual transfers does not concern, right, the cooperation between savers and users of savings. This is the same. What is different is that in the case of contractual transfers, you can aim at specific people who will benefit from your savings. Whereas in the case of non-contractual transfers, I just increase my cash flows. You don't know who will be the beneficiaries, but some people will. And that's absolutely crucial that you understand this. The most natural form of savings does not run counter to the smooth operation of a market economy. There is nothing wrong in having an economy in which cash holding plays a big role. Even if the cash is not held at banks, right, and then intermediated to other people. It's not necessarily a bad thing, and it can be a better thing than a system in which cash is held only at banks and then lent out by banks to other people. Okay, now let's focus on the contractual transfers. And here again, we can distinguish two basic cases. We can buy claims on commodities, and we can buy claims on persons. Claims on commodities concern in particular real estate and consumer durables. And claims on persons are precisely the financial titles that we talked about. I buy from somebody the promise to make a payment to me in the future. I buy a financial title, I buy a security. So here we have then financial markets. And you see, in the whole scheme of things, well, again, all these possibilities can exist side by side, right? It's not logically exclusive in the sense that it cannot coexist in the real world, right? In the real world, you have all of this. You have this, right? Part of the transmission of savings to final use of saving comes in this form, part comes in this form, part comes in this form, pounds comes in this form, right? Here we have logically distinct alternatives according to their characteristics. So financial markets is just one possibility. And again, it's not necessarily the most important vehicle for using savings. It's difficult. I mean, in fact, it's impossible to say anything about the relative importance on a priori grounds. Here we're just interested in the sequence of cause and effect. So we don't know. There's one thing that we can know, we'll look at this later, namely that financial markets have become excessively important due to government interventionism. So whatever the role is in a free society, it's smaller than the one that we right now have. So in the case of claims on personal financial markets, there's a new problem that comes into play, namely the so-called principal and agent problem, right? You hand over your money to somebody else, and so this other person is then your agent, you are the principal, and the interests of the principal and the agent are not necessarily aligned with one another, right? Sometimes you hit the wrong guy, it's just a fraud. He says, yeah, I'm going to invest your money, but he spends it on his vacation. He has this fake company in the Cayman Islands, or I don't know what, right? And your money is gone, or you give it to Madoff or whatever. But even if you don't have outright fraud, sometimes, I mean, they have slightly different orientation than you. They tell you, yes, I'm going to do project A, but he's really doing project B. And sometimes you have the possibility to verify, sometimes not. So you have this new problem that comes into play, which is one of the most important problems, hampering the development of financial markets. That is the reason why, again, in former times, people have typically given their money only to very close friends or even more so relatives. And that is why even today, wealthy families in the U.S. usually run their own investment office as a family investment officer. Don't entrust the money to anybody else. It's a family business. On financial markets, again, we can, and we'll finish with this, right? We can distinguish the case or where this transfer occurs through intermediaries, and the other case where it does not occur through intermediaries. So, for example, it is possible without intermediaries today is virtually, I mean, it's a logical possibility, but it's very, very rare in practice. And for example, it's possible that we buy government bond directly from the U.S. Treasury. That's imaginable, but it's not how it works, right? You always buy it through some intermediary. What is more frequent is that you buy, for example, a share directly from a company, or you don't buy it, you just give money to the company, and in exchange you get the share. So this is more frequent. On the credit market, virtually everything goes through intermediaries. What are the main intermediaries? I'll just name them because, again, we won't go into that detail. Right? So main intermediaries are banks, insurance companies, and investment companies. And invest in different types of investment companies, right, and pension funds and whatever, mutual funds, et cetera, et cetera. Financial structure is very different according to different countries. So in the U.S., you have a predominance of investment funds. Banks come next, and insurance companies are relatively unimportant. In Europe, banks dominate by far. This is something like 60% of all intermediation occurs through banks. Next come insurance companies, and then come investment funds, right? So this is, of course, an interesting subject per se. Why is financial structure different? So for those of you who consider making an academic career, there's ample research to be done. And I can tell you, usually it has something to do with regulations. that's usually the bottom line. Right? In some areas, this type of business is privileged by the law as compared to others. Therefore, this develops more than others and the other way around. Right? Because otherwise there's no reason why on the financial market versus the world market, why you shouldn't align by and large on the most efficient business arrangement. Why should it be different in the US than in Europe? Right? So the explanation is usually it's regulations that come into play. Okay, let's have a look at some comparison of French and American households. So how do we actually use our assets? So I told you, right, in the US we have around $72 trillion, and they have almost $14 trillion of debt. Most of this is real estate debt. Some of it, and the rest is virtually all of it is consumer debt, right? Consumption debt. Out of the assets, we have non-financial assets represent 32%, $23 trillion. And so this is, again, essentially real estate. It's essentially that. And the financial assets, so we have different ones. You see here, it deposits $8 trillion, the famous $8 trillion that I mentioned before, out of 48. So if you do the math, that's almost 17%. 70% of all financial assets. Even in the U.S., and I can tell you, the U.S. is the most capital financial market friendly population that I've come across. Credit market instruments, relatively few. Credit markets instruments are used predominantly by financial intermediaries. Yes, there's a very big market. It's around $40 trillion, right? Most of this is owned by insurance companies, banks, and so on. And then you see here a large chunk of equity shares, which is, again, unusual, which shows that Americans are risk-friendly. So you own a lot of equity. And then we have other stuff, pension funds, especially private equity. So it means that this is it's your own company. So it's the equity capital that you own your own company, but it's not a corporation. Therefore, you don't have shares. It's just, you're just the owner. Okay. Now in France, same year, 2011. I know it's 2010. Right. You have total assets. You see, France is a poor country. There's one seventh or so. And the amazing thing, here is that you, in the French assets, land is already included. Land is very difficult to evaluate, especially the land that nothing is not used, currently used, or is not built on, but the French evaluate it nevertheless. In the U.S., it's not included. The figures is just a very rough impression, but I just tell you, land is not included in the U.S. figure. So all agricultural land, right, is not included. So we have here, you see, non-financial assets represent 66%. So this is a very different attitude, well, cultural attitude toward how you use your savings, very different in France than in the U.S. So as compared to the scheme that we had before, the French prefer claims on things, claims on commodities, to claims on persons. Whereas in the U.S., there's greater trust, maybe, greater love, or maybe greater moral hazard. I don't know. So they invest more, right, in companies and so on. They hand out more credit, so this plays a much bigger role. And debt, right, also American households are much more indebted than French households. And so Americans are more financially savvy, right? And again, now, these figures, right, they are aggregate figures, right? So they do not necessarily, of course, reflect the situation of a typical household in each of the countries, right? One thing that you need to keep in mind is that the distribution of wealth and revenues is much more concentrated in the U.S. than in France, right? So in France, of course, you have also very, very wealthy households. As in the U.S., it's even more concentrated among relatively few families. Okay, but again, right, so the scheme that we have developed does not fully explain these figures, because in the scheme that we have developed before, we just took account of the uses of savings in society, use of savings, not financial markets as a whole. Financial markets, as I've explained to you before, also provide funding based on money creation. So we have different sources here. Right? And this, of course, the figures that we see here, they result from both sources. So we get a glimpse of the real situation, but the real situation results also from factors that we have not yet talked about so far. What are the general consequences of financial markets? And how far can general markets benefit or make a contribution to the market economy as a whole? There are ultimately only two ways through which financial markets can improve the working of the economy. That is, improve. Now, I will qualify this in a minute. The first one is by improving the use that we make of the existing resources. The basic fact is here that financial markets do not create resources. They transmit resources from one end to the other of the economy. And of course, the same thing also holds true even if we consider fractional reserve banks, which create money. It's not because they create money that they create things we can buy with money. That would be great, right? If we could just create, like, by the printing press, some additional chunk of land or nice lemonade or something like that. This would be a useful invention. But all we do with the printing press is to create tickets with which we can buy things that exist nevertheless. Anyway, right? So financial markets do not create resources. They only are a mechanism for using the available resources in a different manner than they would have been used without the financial markets. So the big question is this a better use or not? And indeed, on competitive financial markets, we can at least say there's a certain tendency for available savings to be used in those projects that are supposedly most profitable. Right? Self-interest prompts savers and intermediaries as well, right, to select those projects for financing which promise the highest return. Of course, that's not a guarantee, right? Everybody wants to do fine, right? So it's not a guarantee. You can go wrong, and very often you do go wrong, right? The market economy is not the profit economy, it's the profit and loss economy. Right? So often we do go wrong. Right? If we're prudent, et cetera, well, there's a certain likelihood that we do not completely screw up in the aggregate. And in that case, financial markets can indeed make a contribution to the operation of a market economy. The other way they can do this is by giving greater incentives to save. Without financial markets, how would we use our savings? Well, we would hold them in cash, or we would invest them in our own company. Financial markets do not take away these two alternatives. They provide us a third alternative. Right? So some people who would otherwise not have saved might now be attracted to saving because now, well, or to more to save more because now there's the promise of some return on your investment. So the volume of saving increases, and as a consequence, economic growth is likely to increase as well. These are the two ways through which financial markets can increase the productivity of human labor, and there are no others. Okay, there's nothing else. And one of the problems that we have through, in the case of artificial money creation, is that this competitive selection process is disrupted. And the selection of the most efficient investment projects is premised on the respect of existing property rights. what fractional reserve banking and fiat money do is to disrupt this process. I'll just say this here as a statement. I won't go into much detail. Now let me jump fast to the next session, section, which is the emergence and takeoff of financial markets. So we've gone through the essential ground. I'll just say a few words on the factors that come into play in the emergence of financial markets and especially in the takeoff. So why does it come to the formation of financial markets? Since when do we have financial markets? Well, strictly speaking, we had financial markets for a long time. They've already been known in antiquity. And the first stock markets, forms of the exchange of shares, existed in the 13th century. By the way, it was in France. Out of all countries, yes. And of course, you always had public debt, and you had loans to poor people. So companies typically operated on equity, and debt instruments were known only in the context with public finance and with financing the poor. And that explains us also why there were strict junctures against taking excessive interest from the poor, right? The usury laws. And the guys who were really spoiling it for the poor was in fact the government, because the government provided a ready alternative. We pay you whatever, 2 or 3 or 4% or whatever. So the poor guys, they had to match up that competitor. It was not evident. And so the church and insisted, well, there must be a maximum limit on the amount of interest that you can take from anybody. So what are the motivations of those savers? Well, so one motivation was that money saving hoarding was not perfectly safe either, right? So it's the neighbor who watches you when you dig your hole into your ground. So he comes in the night after you and digs your savings out. It's the guy who robs your house, right? Etc. So that's not perfectly safe either. An additional incentive is the prospect of earning a return or a higher return on savings, right? You could invest the money in your own company, but maybe somewhere else is an even higher return that looms around the corner. And then other so-called non-economic motivations, right? Charity, altruism, and so on. You want to help out other people. There's a worthy project that you want to support, therefore you finance it. The motivations of the users of savings, right, in the case of poor people was bare survival. Very often that was the only way to get around. There was no revenue for the family, so you needed somebody to give you a credit, to loan you money. Bare survival, consumer credit. So this, therefore, also consumer credit for rich people is something that was unknown before the 20th century and probably not even before World War II. So if you think of it, it's a very perverse thing. But, okay. This is my personal value. It's not a priori. It's not praxeology. It's my personal value judgment, right? It's weird, right? I mean, you have money from Africa and China and so on being invested in the U.S. and then handed over to U.S. consumers. It's just crazy. High time preference, right? You could go on with your operation as before. You could perfectly well live with your present level of consumption, but you want to consume more. So you want to take out some money in order to buy the Porsche and whatever else and buy the stuff now. Or for companies, gaining a competitive edge, expansion. Right? So typical motivations. Okay, so we can understand why it comes to financial markets and why financial markets have existed pretty much for 2,000 or 3,000 years. Why did they takeoff? Again, we have here the market forces that came into play. And on my last slide, I will show you the political forces that came into play. So the market forces were the accumulation of capital, right? The Industrial Revolution. This is something that's been taught by the classical economists, my historians, economic historians inspired by the classical economists, was not a technological revolution, but a property rights revolution, right? A revolution of mentalities. People started respecting each other's property rights rather than expropriating one another. So now you could be much more certain than before that your neighbor would not come after you, and especially your government. The neighbor maybe, but not the government. They wouldn't come after you as much as before. Right? So you started accumulating, right? if you have to fear that next year the government comes and expropriates you, takes away your cash from you, expropriates your firm, etc., why should you bother to set it up? But once you are relatively certain that that was not going to happen, well, you start accumulating and investing. Right? So this accumulation of capital was then accumulated to such an extent that it could no longer be profitably invested in the companies of the families and in the family business. So they had to look for other alternatives. So financial markets became one of those outlets. Then we had various legal innovations, for example, limited liability. Without limited liability, there's probably no such thing as a stock market. Because if you buy a share, there's the maximum exposure that you have. You cannot lose more money than the sum that you have spent on buying the share. And even if the company makes losses, you don't share in the losses. Negotiable financial titles, so securities, standardized financial titles, financial engineering today. The role of financial engineering is probably exaggerated, right? If you ask a practitioner, financial engineering to a very large extent consists in developing products or contractual arrangements that allow investors to work around existing financial regulations. Okay? It's not necessarily a more efficient use of capital from an overall point of view. It's a way of getting around, sneaking around existing regulations. So playing according to the law, but not undergoing all the punishment that would come from it. Then the reduction of agency problems with final users of savings. Also, we have reduced transaction costs coming on from financial markets. But we still have a problem with the financial agents, right? If you have a bank account at a very big bank, which opportunity do you have, which possibility do you have to supervise the bank? And the answer is there's virtually none. Unless you are a very big shareholder of a bank, you cannot really effectively supervise the bank. But banks can supervise the money, the persons and the firms to whom they lend money, if they have a share that is big enough. Okay, so these are the main market forces. What are the political forces? Legal privileges and monetary interventionism. I won't go into much detail. Just one example would be the fiscal deductibility of debt. All right, so you can deduct this from your revenue statement to the IRS, the amount of interest that you pay on debt, on your real estate purchase, and so on. But you cannot do the same thing, for example, in the form of opportunity cost. I lend to this and that company about shares in the company. You cannot deduct that. The most important pro-financial market, or let's say inflating force leading to the inflation of financial markets, was monetary interventionism. The most important mechanism here is the following one. Is a mechanism that I describe in my book on the ethics of money production, which is on sale next door. It's the fact that if you have a fiat money regime, then there's a tendency to chronic price inflation. Right? The price level increases constantly. In that context, it becomes suicidal to save in the form of cash. Right? Your cash loses purchasing power by the year and often by the month. Right? So some old people, but really very, very old people, much older than me, haven't realized. So sometimes you find they decease, right? If your grandmother deceases or grandfather, and you find some cans in there, hidden in the house somewhere, full of banknotes, right? It was the savings because they didn't trust the bank, so they saved the tickets at home, right? This is not a very smart way to save under a fiat money regime, right? Because you lose. I mean, imagine the guy he had over $100,000 20 years ago. Now $100,000 is the same purchasing power as a $50,000 20 years ago. So he's lost half of his wealth just by letting it sit there. So once you realize this, well, it's clear what the implication is. You can hold only a part of your wealth in the form of cash. Most of your wealth must be held in something that appreciates with the general price level. Real estate, financial titles, maybe precious metals, something like this. Right? That's the reason that drives people into buying real estate. And that's one of the major reasons that drives real estate prices up, creates real estate bubbles. And it's the reason that makes that inflates the volume of financial markets and therefore the volume of financial intermediaries. And so why did we do this? Well, ultimately, in order to facilitate the financing of governments. And so next time somebody tells you, wow, it's terrible capitalism, all these big banks and so on, and then you sigh and say, well, thanks be to the government. Okay, that was it. Thank you for your attention.